want to speak about the first pasuk in the Sedra. A few different things at this time. We'll try to do something else also in the Sedra. Vayu chayei sara meyash shana v'yesrim shana v'sheva shanim. Shnei chayei sara. So Rashi says, why did it say shana by each thing? Because it said meyash v'sheva shanim. Why meyash shana, esrim shana? So Rashi says that according to one version of the Rashi and one version of the Medrash, it goes like this. At 100, she was as pure as she was at 20 regarding sin. Just like at 20, she was free from sin. At 100 also. And at 20, she was as beautiful as she was at 7. So I want to discuss what that means. First of all, why 20? Right? Why is that the line of demarcation that she was free from sin? We know that a girl becomes bas mitzvah at 12. So from 12 on, she could have had sins. So what's this 20 years old? So it is a common thing that people know that until you're 20, you are not punished from the Beis Nishamala. Kores, right? People make a fast or whatever on the day they become 20, because from this point on they're liable in the heavenly court. Till then, not. Which is and that's what it says. So till 20, Sara Imenu was free from sin vis-a-vis the heavenly court. The earthly court judges from 13, but the heavenly court only judges from 20. Now that would seem to imply that if you do something that you're chayiv kores. For instance, you eat on Yom Kippur, you eat chametz on Pesach, right? And you're chayiv kores, that won't take effect until you're 20. From 13 on not, or 12 on for a girl. But the chayiv, that's not true. Because things that you're chayiv kores on, if you do them b'shogeg, you have to bring a korban chatos. And the halacha is clear that even a 12-year-old girl and 13-year-old boy have to bring a korban chatos. If they're mechal Shabbos b'shogeg, or they eat something that's asur b'kares b'shogeg, they have to bring a korban chatos. So also, the Rambam says clearly that if somebody does not have a bris milah, he's chayiv kares. When does that chiyuv start? From the time he's 13 and on. Doesn't say anything about 20. So what is this concept that you're not liable in the Beis Nishamala till you're 20? What does it apply to? So there are many explanations. I'm going to give you a few of them. First of all, that halacha, that until you're 20, you're not liable in the Beis Nishamala, is not for punishments that are delineated in the Torah, like Kores, Misa B'dei Shamayim. Those have the same law as things that are from the earthly court, because they're enumerated in the Torah. Torah says specifically, you do this, you get this spiritual punishment. That applies from the time you're 13 or 12. But there are punishments that are given that aren't delineated in the Torah. Things that the Rabbanu Shel Olam deems a person guilty of or whatever, that there's no specific punishment mentioned in the Torah, but onshei shamayim, right? Like most punishments that come are not things that are delineated in the Torah. A person gets sick, rachmana litzlan, or a million different things that can happen that sometimes are punishments, right? Those kinds of things, a person is not affected by them till he's 20. That's not something that specifically is delineated in the Torah as a punishment for a specific sin. But the more unqualified kinds of punishments, those don't come from heaven till 20. That's one answer. Another answer they say is that you don't even kores. You don't get the actual kores at 13 or 12. The Rabbanu Shalom waits till you're 20 to see if you did tshuva. If you did tshuva, then you're lucky. If you didn't do tshuva, then you get the kores retroactively from the time you're 13 or 12. Okay, what difference that makes, I don't know, but that's what it says. Okay. Another possibility. This concept that a person was not liable to heavenly judgments before they were 20 only applied before the Torah was given. Sarimenu. Still before the Torah was given. Once the Torah was given, the halacha became that you're liable to everything from the time you're 12 or 13. So it's basically irrelevant today. It was only relevant before the Torah was given. It's another possibility. Another possibility is, we explained in the past that there are two kinds of punishments for every kind of sin. There's what's called the doctor aspect and the king aspect. You're punished because you rebelled against God, and you're also punished because the thing itself is harmful to you. The punishment comes from the thing itself because it's harmful. Then there's a punishment for rebelling against God. That's the king punishes you for rebellion. That you're not chayiv is only that the king won't punish you till you're 20. But the effect of the sin itself has an effect from the time you're 13 or 12. Could be that even has an effect before that. So therefore, you may have to bring a sacrifice to get away that effect. Right? Your chayiv kares, meaning that the effect of the kares, the effect of the sin, will affect you from the time you're 13 or 12. But God won't punish you as a king till you're 20. That's the difference. So there is a reason to bring a korban if you sin from the time you're 13 or 12 to take away the effect of the sin. But the actual full punishment from the king, that won't come till you're 20. So those are all possibilities of what it means she was at 100 as she was at 20, l'chait, for these kinds of chatoim, for these kinds of sins that don't take effect till you're 20, she at 100 had the same status as when she was 20. Okay, the second thing also needs explanation. And she was as pretty as 20 as she was when she was 7. Now, I don't know, maybe I'm different than other people, but in my estimation, a 20-year-old girl is prettier than a 7-year-old. Okay? Unless you're a pedophile. Right? L'chora, that's the way the world is. So what does it mean? Sari Mena was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. So I think that what it means is the following. I think we once discussed this, but I'm going to mention it quickly, or not so quickly, but concisely. What is the concept of tznius? Right? Tznius, covering your body. The body is something bad, erotic, has to be covered. If that's the case, then we should surely be machmir to cover animals' bodies. If a human body is not good, then the animal body is even worse. And I don't know anybody yet, could be tomorrow, there will be, but today, as of today, I don't know of anybody who's machmir to go to the zoo only if the animals are dressed. Okay? They don't dress animals anywhere except maybe in Los Angeles, and there they don't dress people. So it's so they have to dress somebody, so they dress the animals. And that has nothing to do with tznius. So what is this concept? So we've explained in the past, tznius is the following. Wherever there is an inner, intrinsic, spiritual essence, and that is the main thing, that inner spiritual essence. But you could be distracted by the externals and think that that's all there is and ignore the spiritual essence. Or play down its importance and think that the external physical essence is more important. We cover the externals and distract attention from the externals to make the statement there's more here than meets the eye. Therefore, before the sin of Adam and Chava, it was very clear that the main thing of a person was their neshama. And the body was merely a suit of clothing that the neshama wore in order to function in this world. I always like to compare it to an astronaut. An astronaut, as long as he's on terra firma, he can breathe without oxygen apparatus, he can get along without a pressurized suit. He can speak without a radio, can function very nicely. But once he goes into outer space, so he needs a pressurized suit to be able to function. He needs a radio to talk because there are no sound waves. He needs oxygen apparatus to breathe through because there's no atmosphere. When he comes back to Earth, takes off the suit. We are neshamas. We were created as neshamas and we lived in a spiritual world for thousands of years before we came into this world. And in that spiritual world, we could function very nicely. We could hear without ears and see without eyes and get around without arms and legs. But we came into this physical world and our neshama needed a spacesuit to wear to be able to function. In this physical world, you need eyes to see and ears to hear and arms and legs to get around with. So the Rebbe Mishram gave us a spacesuit called a body. And the body is just a suit of clothing that the neshama wears to function in this physical world. When we go back to the spiritual world, we leave the body here. Could be the form. That's one reason why we express mourning for somebody who dies by tearing our clothing. To show that it's only the clothing that's been torn away. But the essence of the person still exists. Once Adam and Chava sinned, and they used their body against their neshama, things became very unclear. Now it's not so clear that the neshama is the main thing, and the body only serves as an apparatus to enable the neshama to function in this world, because the body functioned against the best wishes, the best interests of the neshama. So maybe the body is not the secondary thing. Maybe the body is the main thing. Maybe there is no neshama. I don't see any neshama. Maybe there is no neshama. Maybe there's only a body. Because it's hard to say the body is only a tool of the neshama when the body functions against. Then you needed a beged. The word beged comes from the word bogade, to rebel, to be a traitor. When the body rebelled against the neshama and sinned and did something that wasn't good for the neshama, you needed a beged to make the following statement. Don't be distracted by the externals. There's more here than meets the eye. And the main thing is what you can't see. So we cover the external to distract attention from it and to make the statement there's more here than meets the eye. The main thing is what you can't see. Therefore, by an animal, where what you see is what you get, there is no neshama. There's nothing, no reason to cover the body. We only cover the body not because there's something wrong with the body, but because if you give the body its real importance, that it is a suit of clothing that enables the neshama to function, then the body is very important. But if all there is a body, then you're an animal. So we cover the body to accentuate its importance. Don't get carried away with the externals, because there's more here than meets the eye that is the main thing, and that is the internal. Okay, if that's the case, then we should cover the body in such a way that we totally ignore it. Should wear a tent. Right? People should walk around in tents with a hood and two eyes. That's it. Right? That's like what? Some people do that. What? Right. Why don't we do that? We wear clothing that is form-fitting, that is nice, colorful, at least by some people. Black is all... Right. White is all the colors together. So a person wears black and white, at least he has no color and all colors. But women at least wear, what's it called, dress colorfully, nicely. Right? Why? Why don't we dress in such a way that totally ignores the body and says what you can see is useless, nothing, just concentrate on the neshama? Says the Vilna Gaon on the pasuk Sheker Hachein, the Hevel Hayofi, Isha Yiras Hashem Itisalo, right? That beauty and charm are vain and false, but in a woman that praises that fears God, she should be praised. Says the Vilna Gaon. It means is the following: when beauty and charm are all there is externally, then they are vain and false. But in a woman who fears God, she should be praised for her beauty and her charm. Then the beauty and charm serve a purpose in a woman that fears God. Meaning the following. Chanukah is coming, which reminds me, I will not be here next week, the week after that, or the week after that. I'm not coming back Erev Chanukah. I'm going to the States on Monday night, Mirtz Hashem. I should be returning Friday morning, Erev Chanukah. So what I'm saying now for Chanukah is very in place, since you won't see me till Erev. Chanukah, we probably won't have a shiur because people are busy Chanukah playing dreidel, eating latkes, and a host of other things. So what's it called? Chanukah's coming. Okay, Chanukah, for sure, we have an idea of Hiddur Mitzvah. We try to get a very pretty, nice Chanukah menorah, right? Chanukiah, that looks nice. L'chora, why don't we say, Hanukkah mitzvahs are the main things are spiritual. Physical is not important. So you get the ugliest menorah that you can, which I know some people do, but in any case, in my estimation, right, and play down the physical and accentuate the spiritual. The answer is that we're human beings and we're affected by what we see. And yes, the inner spiritual is the main thing. But how do you sense that inner spiritual value by it being expressed externally? So when you see a beautiful Hanukkah menorah, right, if it's tasteful, it gives you a feeling of respect and the beauty of the mitzvah. It enhances the beauty of the mitzvah. And that is what a beautiful, but if you have a beautiful Hanukkah menorah that some kind of, I don't know what, doesn't express that beauty of the mitzvah at all, it gives a different message. That's not the beauty we're talking about. An example. Physical beauty, when it's only skin deep, okay, is extremely subjective. It's a very culturally subjective thing. In one society, what's considered pretty, in another society, is not pretty. The example I always give is the Ubangi warriors, right? Right? Ubangis have this quaint custom of putting a half saucer in their daughters' mouths when they're little girls, little saucer, half saucer, between their gums and their upper lip. And it stretches their upper lip. As they get older, they put a bigger saucer, till they're about 15, 16, their upper lip sticks out about a foot. Okay, that's how you have to see a picture of them. Look at the encyclopedia, right? It's interesting that the women of the Ubangi tribes are called Sari. So it has to do with this Sedra too. In any case, but that, if you ever see a Ubangi woman, she has a lip that sticks out about a foot. Okay. If you don't have a lip that sticks out a foot amongst the Ubangis, you'll never find a shidduch. So that's beautiful. Now, in our circles, if your daughter has an upper lip that sticks out a foot, you send her to the orthodontist, spend thousands of dollars to correct the situation, because otherwise she'll never find a shidduch. Okay. I had a daughter who needed orthodontia work. I was thinking of sending her to the Ubangis. It was much cheaper. Right. Except the shidduchim, they were a little too black for me. So what's beautiful? You ask the Ubangi, the upper lip sticking out a foot is beautiful. You ask a person from America, not beautiful at all. And it says by Esther Hamalka, Esther found charm in everybody's eyes. She was like beautiful to everybody. How could that be? Either she had an upper lip that stuck out a foot or she didn't. Either she was beautiful to the Ubangis or beautiful to the Americans. She couldn't be beautiful to both of them. The answer is that kind of beauty is not what we're talking about. When the Torah says that Sara Imenu was beautiful, it was a universal beauty. What's a universal beauty? The beauty of a seven-year-old. The innocence of youth. The purity of youth. That is a universal thing. It's not subjective. It's not cultural. It's something that it's the inner beauty of youth and innocence that shines externally. That's the kind of beauty Sari Menu had. Her inner beauty shone to the surface. That's real tznius. Real tznius is just not just covering your body and distracting attention from the externals. It's how you distract attention. It's what kind of tasteful way you cover the body that gives the message that beneath that clothing there is something holy and pure that is represented externally by the tasteful way that a person dresses. That's real tznius. It's a combination of distracting attention from the physical as a value in itself and conveying that inner spiritual essence in a very physical way. That's why clothing is called beged, because it represents the bogade, but it's also called mechabdusi, that which gives me honor. You relate to a person as they dress, right? If a policeman When you see him in his uniform, right, it puts a chill down your spine, especially when you're driving and he says, whatever, right? So, but if that same policeman would be in a Bermuda shirt and Bermuda shorts, it wouldn't be the same thing. I remember I had in Miami, I had many doctors in my kehillah. And most of them would do their rounds in the hospital in a white coat, you know, and conservative, white shirt, blue shirt, whatever, a stethoscope around their neck. But in Miami, there were some doctors, right, who would go make their rounds in shorts and these colorful shirts or whatever. You couldn't relate to a doctor like that as the same as you relate to a doctor in a white coat or whatever. It's just not the same, right? That's why they wear uniforms in the army, because there's a certain respect and achdus when everybody's dressed the same way in the same uniform. Not the same if everybody's dressed, you know, comes in their sweatshirts and short pants, doesn't bring the same feeling and the same respect or whatever. Doesn't clothing is not the ikker, but it definitely, there is something to it of how, what message it gives out externally, what is going on internally. So therefore it says when Sari Menu was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7, it's talking about that kind of beauty, the kind of beauty that is universal, the kind of beauty that a 7-year-old has, which is a universal representation of that innocence of youth. That kind of beauty is not culturally subjective. It's a universal kind of thing. It's what represents what's on the inside externally. It's conveyed externally what is the inner value. Okay. Then the last thing Rashi says is, Shnei Chayei Sarah, Kulam Shavim Latova. They all were equally for the good. Now, you can't understand that literally, because all of Sarah's life was equally good. Not true. Right? The 90 years she didn't have any children wasn't the same as the 37 years she had Yitzchak. The night she was dragged to Paro wasn't the same as the day they celebrated Yitzchak's bris. They weren't equally good. The answer is it doesn't say they were equally good. It says they were equally for the good. Kulam shavim litova. Meaning, Sarah Imenu was able to take every situation that came her way and use it for the good. Somehow, be on top of it and not be a victim of circumstance, but be able to utilize what she couldn't control. We can't control the situations that come to us in life, but we can control how we relate to them. That's what's in our control, how to relate to it. And that is the ultimate malchus. That is the ultimate royalty. A person who can control himself and control how he relates to things that are beyond his control. You can't control the situation, but you can control your reaction, how you use it. And that's why the Medrash says, based on this, Medrash says Rabbi Akiva was giving a drasha, and his students began to fall asleep. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years. And Rabbi Akiva wanted to wake them up. So he said to them the following, what did Esther see that enabled her to rule over 127 Medinos? Let Esther, the great-great-granddaughter of Sarah, who lived 127 years, rule over 127 Medinos. So they all woke up. What in the world is the connection between Esther's Medinos and Sarah's years, except for the fact that the number's the same? And Rabbi Akiva went on. What was he trying to tell them? So I think, perhaps, an idea is the following. Rabbi Akiva was telling them the following, that Sarah Imenu didn't live 127 just years. She ruled over all of her years, kulam shavim latova. She was able to control every situation, even bad situations, and make the best of them. She was the ultimate malka, the ultimate royalty. And Esther Hamalka learned from her how to control herself and the situation she came to and make the best of them. Right? Because if she didn't, when she was taken to the king Achashverosh, taken away from her family, she could have just resigned herself to a melancholy life. But she didn't. She made the best of the situation. She ended up saving the Jewish people because of that. So what did Esther see? What impressed her that enabled her to rule over 127 medinos and not say, I'm in a real bad situation, I can't control this, I'm taken away, I'm part of the harem of this Goyisha king, right, and just give up and just become totally inactive and depressed? Because she learned from Sari Imenu that the most difficult situations, if you use them properly, you can make the best of them. As long as you're on top of the situation and you're not ruled by it, you're the one in charge. You're the one who can function, who can rise above the situations that come your way that you can't control, but you can control how you react to them. So what did Esther see that enabled her to rule over 127 medinos? She learned from Sari Imenu that even in the most difficult situations, you can still be in control and use it for the good. So she was in a very difficult situation. She used it for the good, and she ended up saving the Jewish people. Says Rabbi Akiva, it's not easy to stay up during a shir. Right? You like to nod off. What's it called? You hear it, you get tired, you whatever. It's not easy. I never said it's easy. But it's a lot easier than the things that Sarah had to go through. It's a lot easier than the things that Esther had to go through. And they were able to make the best of a bad situation. They were in control. You can be in control too and stay up. That's what Rabbi Akiva was telling his Talmidim. Right? Yeah, it's not easy. Nobody said it's easy. Life is not easy. But if a person wants to, he can exhibit the quality of malchus, be a real melech. A real melech is not people who rule, a person who rules over other people. A real melech is a person who can rule over himself, who can exercise self-control, can make the best of bad situations. That's a real melech. So that's what Rabbi Akiva told his Talmidim. Right? It's not easy. And I know it's hard to stay up. Right? It's not hard to stay up on this side of the shir. Much harder to be on the other. I would always rather be speaking than listening. No shaila. Because on the other side, it's much, much more difficult. But I've yet to fall asleep during a drasha that I give Friday night. Right? But on the other hand, when I have to listen to drashas Friday night, right, it's very hard to stay up. Very, very hard. So I can empathize with the people who are sleeping before me, feel that I'm doing them a service, right, by at least letting them sleep, right, not speaking too loud so I don't wake them up. I had rabbi's children are like shoemaker's children, you know. Most of them never stayed in for my drushas. One daughter that's a malumeda, she used to stay in for my drusha and then in the end say, Tati, I liked your question, but I have a much better answer. And she usually did. But my sons usually didn't stay in for the drusha. Like all kids, teenagers, rabbi starts to speak, they're outside, fraternizing or whatever. That's the way of the world. So once my son was already 18, right, he's getting a little more mature, so he stayed in for my drusha. And my youngest son. And at the end of the drusha, he said, Tati, it was really a great drusha, but it wasn't long enough. I said, wow, not only does he like the drusha, right, he stayed in, but he really liked it so much he wanted to continue. He said, I was just getting a good sleep and you stopped. So much for that. So I can empathize with people. It's hard to stay up. But that's what Rabbi Akiva told us to meet him. I'm not discounting the fact that it's hard to stay up and pay attention during a shir. But it's not harder than what Esther had to go through, and it's not harder than what Sarah had to go through. And it's possible to make the best of a bad situation. So if all you're asked to is to make the effort to stay up, it's a lot easier than what they had to go through. That's what Rabbi Akiva told his Talmidim, at least according to one explanation that I have. Okay. Another point. It says that Avraham Avinu wants to find a shidduch for Yitzchak. So he calls in Eliezer, he tells him, I don't want you to take a wife from the Canaanim who live in their midst. I want you to go and get a wife from my family. So the obvious question is, knowing who Avraham's family was, what was the great shakes of getting a girl from his family? He couldn't find a girl amongst the Canaanim, right, that also was an exception? I mean, Rivka was not a product of her family. She wasn't like her father or her brother, right, or her mother or whatever. She was the exception. So there weren't any Canaan exceptions, and if you think there weren't, Eliezer Eved Avram was a Canaanite, right? And he was what's it called, an exemplary Talmud of Avram Avinu. And now he had a daughter. So what was wrong with his daughter? So there are many answers. I'm going to give you some of them. We could spend probably a shiur on each one, but we won't. So we'll just do this concisely. First, what Rashi says. The Canaanim were cursed. And the Jewish people, Shem, was blessed. Ein orim mistabik beborach. They don't mix. What does that mean? If you could find Eliezer was cursed. Eliezer was a fine person. He had a daughter, probably a tzaddikus. So what was this idea of a curse? A curse means that there's something intrinsically, there's a flaw, a blemish intrinsic to this person. The word klala comes from the word kal. Something, what's it called, light. A flaw. Just like a bracha. What does bracha mean? Bracha means to increase. You have something, and now you can increase it, strengthen it, or whatever. A klala is a blemish. And if you give a klala, it increases that blemish. Right? It brings it out more, it weakens it more, or whatever. Because if you have a weakness, you want to weaken it so it doesn't hurt something, or what. So Noah saw an intrinsic blemish in Ham, in Canaan, his son, and he accentuated it, and he, what's it called, made it even a bigger blemish, or whatever, that it should not harm others or harm whatever, but it's there. It may not come out, it's like a genetic disease. You may have generations where that genetic disease may not come out, but it's there laying dormant, and three generations it may come out. Avraham Avinu said, I may find somebody like Eliezer who's a perfect guy. His daughter, perfect. But I can't be guaranteed that that genetic, spiritual genetic blemish isn't going to come out two, three generations from now. And that's why ultimately the Rabbanu Shlom said the Canaanim have to be destroyed. Because they had this genetic blemish and it was a blight on the world. So the Rabbanu Shlom who gave them life said their life has to be taken away. They've reached a point where there's no hope for them. And it may skip a generation, there may be exceptions, but ultimately it's a blight on the world, and the world needs these people to be eradicated. Okay, that is one idea. So Avraham Avinu said, my family is not cursed, they're blessed. Again, there may be exceptions, maybe a lot of exceptions of people who aren't what they're supposed to be. But if I find somebody good, it could last then for generations. It's not going to crop up this spiritual defect. That's one pshat. Second pshat. There's nothing wrong with the Canaanim, and there's nothing great about Avram's family. Avram's consideration was different. His consideration was like this. If I marry my son to a girl from around here, he's going to be influenced by her family. The girl I can influence, I can't influence her whole family. They're going to spend Shabbos with the parents of the bride, right, of the wife's side. They're going to go for Yom Tovim. They're going to come to visit. And they're going to have a bad influence on my son. You can pick who your child marries. You can't pick your mechutanim, right? And you can't change them either. So Avraham Avinu said, no matter what my family is, no matter what these people are, I have to marry my son to somebody from far away who's going to come here under my influence, not the influence of her parents. That's a second idea. It had nothing to do with intrinsically his family being better than the people around. It's just that these were close and these were far. Better to marry from somebody far away. Third idea. Rosham Shemfel Hirsch says, Avraham Avinu knew there is no girl in the world that is fit at that point to be the wife of Yitzchak Avinu. She's going to have to be groomed. She's going to have to be influenced. Right? She grew up in a house of idolatry. But she has the potential. So I can take a girl with potential and build her up. Okay? So whoever I'm going to marry to Yitzchak is going to be somebody that I am going to groom. why should I do that to a stranger when I can do it to my family? We have a halacha that if you have tzedakah money to give, give it first to your family before you give it to a stranger. You always have a responsibility to those closest to you before those who are farther away. So if you have to be mashpi on somebody, you're going to have to be makariv somebody, be makariv your family instead of being makariv somebody farther away. Even though the truth is, it's much more difficult to makariv your family than makariv strangers. Strangers are easy to do. Family is very difficult. But Avraham Avinu said, okay, these are family that, you know, or cousins, whatever, not direct family, I have a responsibility to them before I have a responsibility to a stranger. If I'm going to have to be makar of somebody, why shouldn't it be my family? That's a presumption flourish. I don't know if it's his own or he got it from someone, whatever. That's another possibility. Avraham Avinu said, if I marry my son to a daughter of Canaan, later on when we inherit Eretz Yisrael, you know what people are going to say? You know why they got this land? Through the wife's side. They inherited it through the wife's, what's it called, Yitzchak Avinu's wife's parents. That's why we have a share in the land of Canaan, because we intermarried with the Canaanim and we inherited from them. Avraham Avinu didn't want anybody to ever think such a thing. So if he didn't marry into the Canaanim at all, then no one could ever think that we inherited Eretz Canaan because we inherited from the other side. But we got it because the Rabbanim wanted to give it to us. Which leaves us the last pshat, and that's the Ran, which on the surface is very difficult. The Ran says, yes, Avraham Avinu's family were no great sheikhs. They were idol worshippers. But their problem was in ideology. They had bad ideas, bad beliefs. Belief does not go on generation after generation. It's something in a person's head. You can change a person's belief. You can re-educate a person. You can re-educate the next generation. The Canaanim had bad midos. They had bad character traits. Bad character traits go on from generation to generation. They can be passed on from one generation. It could skip a generation, but it's there. And if the parents had bad character traits, it's dormant in the children. They can uproot it. They can change it. But if they don't, it can go on from generation to generation, bad character traits. Therefore, Avraham Avinu, like we said with the Klala, said, I can re-educate somebody who has bad ideas, but it's very hard to change people's mitos. And therefore, I'd rather marry into my family than into the Canaanim who had bad mitos. Now, it's a very nice word, but it doesn't seem to fit what the Torah speaks about Avraham's family. These are not people who are just idol worshippers with impeccable mitos. This was love and harami. Right? They were cheats, liars. What kind of good mythos? Who's the Ran talking about? These weren't just idol worshippers of bad mythos. So one way of explaining it is possible. There's two kinds of bad character. There's bad character that comes from bad ideas. Because I have bad ideas, I adopt bad behavior. And there's some ways the opposite. Because I have bad behavior, I adopt bad ideas. The Canaanim were the second way. Their bad behavior was the foundation. Therefore, it was hard to change them. By Avraham's family, yes, they had bad midos. But their midos came from their bad ideas, which caused them to then get bad character. So they could be re-educated, and then the character will come better. That's one way. I have a different way. Character traits that the Ran is talking about that could be transmitted from generation to generation are not just if somebody doesn't have good behavior. That's not bad character traits. That's no character traits. Somebody who doesn't work on his midos, on his character, has no character. It's not that he has good or bad. If he doesn't work on it for the good, it's not good. If he doesn't work on it for the bad, it's not bad. It's just no character. He just does whatever comes, you know, whatever he feels to do at that time. That's not a character. That's just, he does things by whim, by whatever comes up, whatever desire is at the moment. That's not called good character. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz points out, we normally think that a person who's not a ganav is somebody who's never stolen anything. That's not true. Because if you could come to a situation where all the circumstances would be ideal for you to steal, and you'd steal, then you're potentially a ganav. What separates you between the guy who's stolen and you? Circumstance. the circumstances never presented themselves where you feel comfortable stealing. Who's not a ganav? Somebody who never could steal, no matter what the circumstances were. He's worked on himself that he's in control, that he can't steal. That he's totally in control of his personality. That's called good midos. Bad midos are the opposite, where you've worked on yourself and inculcated with yourself bad character traits, not just because you can't control yourself, because you're controlling yourself for the bad. Avraham Avinu's family didn't have bad midos. They didn't have any midos. They did whatever, whatever was beneficial for them at the time. That's why the Torah, the Kli Yoker, says, it's every time it mentions Lavan, Lavan ho arami mipadan aram. Why mention that? Says the Kli Yoker to tell me, you know why Lavan was a cheat? Not because intrinsically he worked on himself to become a cheat. Because the people around him, he was from Padan Aram, they all were cheats. So he followed he went with the flow. Followed the crowds. But not because he worked on himself to develop these bad character traits. He just never had any character, so he went along with the flow. Had he been somewhere else, he would have gone with the flow there. So Avraham Avinu said those kind of character traits don't go from generation to generation. Because there's nothing substantial about them. They're the lack of character. But the Knanim really worked on their character for bad. I'll prove it to you. I'll give you two examples of what the Gemara says, what the Knanim did. That you can't just do because you don't have any character. This you really have to work on. They used to have the following custom. When their parents got to a certain age, old age. So like people today, old people are a burden on society. They don't contribute to the economy. They drain the economy. And therefore, it's a good idea to get rid of them as fast as possible. And therefore, we encourage them to commit suicide if they're a bother to society. And the next step is we encourage them to submit to murder if, forced suicide if they're a burden on society. That's the way people think. Okay, so that's, you can do that in a nice, way. But the Canaanim are worse than that. They said, yeah, our old parents are a burden on society, and getting rid of them will alleviate that problem. But there's no real gain by getting rid of them. First of all, you have to pay for the poison, you have to whatever it may be, but a bullet costs money. So they had a better idea. When their parents reached a certain age and they felt that they weren't productive anymore, they used to feed them to their dogs. So they saved the meal from the dogs. So not only didn't they got rid of these parents who were a burden on society, they also saved, some dog food, right? They fed their parents. Now, that doesn't come from somebody who doesn't have character. That you have to really work on. Or, on the other end of life, they use their children to better their situation, okay? So they abuse their children to the ultimate of sacrificing their children to Molech. So, sacrifice your children to Molech, if it means cutting his throat, then burning his body. Okay, that's halvatzara. They didn't do that. They had this quaint custom of taking their little babies and passing them over a fire to a priest, slowly roasting them to death. Okay, again, you can't do that unless you really worked on your midos, right, to make yourself really cruel. You can't take a little baby, right, you can take a little baby and kill it on the spot. But to torture it to death slowly, right, and roast it over a fire slowly, back and forth, for that you really have to inculcate real cruelty. So the Knanim were just not lacking character. They inculcate themselves bad character. That goes on for generations. No character doesn't go on anywhere. So that kind of no character, you could re-educate people or whatever, and that's why Avraham Avinu felt more comfortable with his family than with the Canaanite.